the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. And as your announcer told you, this program is supported by listeners. And I want to single out Doug Zimmerman of Columbus, Ohio. Got a check from you, Doug. Thank you very much. You can help, too. Subscriptions are voluntary, and they start as low as $5 a month. Details are right there at peterbcollins.com. In this program, you'll hear multiple voices responding to the squeaking passage, 220 to 215, of the House of Representatives' version of the health care reform package. It's really a health insurance reform package, and it's really modifications to health insurance. The word reform doesn't really apply, at least not from my point of view. And later on in this program, Dr. Len Saputo and Byron Belitsos will return to our microphones. They co-authored a book called A Return to Healing, and they joined us for a look at these issues in August when, the crazies fueled by Dick Armey's Freedom Works and Americans for Prosperity were out there disrupting town hall meetings, and Sarah Palin Facebooked us with the death panels. And we're going to get another take from Dr. Saputo and Byron Belitsos as they evaluate the work of the House of Representatives and the prospects for additional work in the United States Senate. I almost said the word improvements, but when you look at the composition of the Senate and you look particularly at the recalcitrant Democrats and the wobbly Joe Lieberman, you can't expect improvements. And this is one of my gripes with the Democrats all along, which is that they compromised with themselves, they compromised too far, too soon, and by really pushing single-payer off the table, and even the Kucinich state-by-state single-payer amendment, which disappeared when the Speaker produced her version of the bill, well, there isn't that much left to debate and negotiate over. And what we can expect is just more corporate-oriented results coming from the work in the United States Senate. So we'll talk about the big picture of what's in the bill, what's not in the bill, and whether we've reached that point where it's better to do nothing than pass a bad bill. We'll talk about that with Dr. Saputo and Mr. Belitsos a little bit later. We're joined now by Angela Bonavolia. She's an award-winning journalist and author, who is recognized for her writing about women and the Catholic Church. Her most recent book is called Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. And she's a former contributing editor at Ms. Magazine. Angela Bonavolia, welcome to our program today.
Thanks so much, Peter. It's good to be here.
Now, one of the big surprises, I flipped on C-SPAN on Saturday last weekend, and I was a little surprised to see Bart Stupak holding the floor, and his draconian amendment, which took the Hyde Amendment, which had banned the use of federal dollars for payment for abortions, to a new low. And I'm very concerned that not only did the Stupak Amendment pass, but we have Ben Nelson and others in the Senate who are now encouraged by this, and they will put similar language in the Senate bill, so that hoping that the Stupak Amendment would disappear in the conference committee because there was no counterpart in the Senate, that's a real long shot. Now, first of all, were you surprised that the Stupak Amendment got to the floor at all?
I was stunned, Peter. I was stunned. I just watched the whole thing unfold, and I was really aghast. This, as you said, it takes the Hyde Amendment, and it goes just light years beyond what the Hyde Amendment was, which was that there was no federal funding for women's abortions except in cases of rape and incest and life of the mother. And now we have an amendment that essentially says none of the private insurers who participate in the health insurance exchanges that we're going to be having can provide abortion coverage. And none of the subsidies can be used for those policies. So it really means that while most insurers today provide abortion coverage, in the marketplace insurers are not going to be able to provide it, and in the public option it's not going to be provided.
Mm-hmm.
So women, even using their own money, there will be people buying into the exchanges with their own money, even they will not be able to do it. And the only option is for women to buy a rider. And why should anybody have to do that? Why are they singling out one medical procedure and basically saying no woman can have this procedure?
Well, and the idea of taking out a rider is it's infuriating in so many respects, because what are we going to do? Put a machine up next to the condom machine in bathrooms and say, hey, you're going to party tonight? You might want to take out some abortion insurance. nobody plans for an unplanned pregnancy. It's as simple as that. And so to separate this out and require women to, plan that far ahead and essentially plan for an abortion.
Plan for an unplanned pregnancy.
Yeah. This is clearly something that came from men.
Well, and also...
And I can say that.
Yes, you can. And it also came from a truly disturbing marriage of the Catholics and the evangelicals, which, as I'm listening and watching the news and what's going on around me, is becoming even more clear and even more disturbing. I'm sure your listeners have noticed that there's been a lot of a confirmation that the bishops had a tremendous hand in pressuring the lawmakers to pass this. Certainly Stupak has said that very directly, that he worked very closely with the bishops. Well, Rachel Maddow, on her wonderful show yesterday, talked with Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power.
That's where right-wing Republicans bunk in Washington and go to get counseling when their mistresses don't behave properly.
Exactly. Well, he pointed out that Joe Pitts, the co-sponsor of this bill, who is himself an evangelical, has been involved as a core member of the family since 1976, working very hard on the anti-choice agenda, and has even been publicly explained an objective of his work as being to, quote, create a God-led government. So you've got the Catholic Church, which I don't think people realize, but the Catholic Church's position is that its moral positions, such as natural law, which is what they base all of the anti-contraception, anti-pregnancy, anti-abortion, all of that, those positions on, that those that natural law should apply to everybody, not just Catholics. So you've got really this partnership of Pitts and Stupak doing this, Stupak moving a religious agenda forward and really moving us closer to a Christian theocracy. And that scares me more than anything.
Well, that's why I invited you on today, Angela, because a quote that I picked up from you is something that I think is very powerful. I'm going to read it here in a second. And I used it on a blog post that I put up the other day, and I've been carrying it around and passing it around to my recovering Catholic friends. And just For your information, I grew up Catholic, was trained by the Jesuits, and I believe Jesus Christ was a great guy. I don't support the churches that operate in his name. And in particular, the Catholic Church in recent years here in California has gotten involved in the effort to block same-sex marriages. And their intrusion into that process last year, the passage of Proposition 8 to roll back a civil right that was granted, is unchristian, in my view. And I think that their interference in politics and secular policies is something that we have to look at and put a stop to right here, right now, because we are on the verge of becoming the kind of radical fundamentalist theocracy that you referred to, and that's the kind of zeitgeist that we're at war with. And I don't particularly support that war. I don't think it's very well framed or very effective. But that said, we cannot let ourselves become captive to the same kinds of influences that we have arrayed ourselves against.
Oh, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I really shudder to think how deeply these influences have made it into our legal system. I mean, these are the motivators for laws that should be secular and not influenced by religion and somebody's beliefs about what religion should be, particularly, as you say, I mean, I too grew up Catholic, particularly a church that is so clearly anti-woman and unable to integrate women into the institution in a meaningful way. And not only that, is really, women suffer at the hands of this institution, left and right.
And let me read your quote, because in a couple of sentences here, you captured quite a bit. Once again, the all-male, theoretically celibate Catholic hierarchy has been allowed to exert its outsized influence on proposed American law, further depriving women of basic health care and pushing us one step closer to becoming a Christian theocracy. One is hard-pressed to identify another institution, religious or secular, that is so callously and self-righteously anti-woman and still retains such a degree of, quote, moral authority. Now, I think that you have said a lot there. First of all, it is a fraternity. It's all male.
Absolutely.
It is theoretically celibate.
Yes.
And we have so many exceptions to that theory. Most notably, the new president, I think it's of Paraguay, is a Catholic bishop. And in his first month in office, I believe that three different paternity suits or paternity claims have been presented against him.
Yes, you are absolutely right. Yes.
No, you go ahead.
The church is in such denial about this still that recently the New York Times did a fabulous front page story about a woman who had been involved with a priest. Became pregnant. He urged her to have an abortion. She didn't. She gave birth to the child. The child is now an adult. He has cancer. She has cancer. And she's struggling to get the his order to give her funding so that they can have the medical care that they need. And I just, you know, our new archbishop here in New York, Dolan, wrote a rant on his blog declaring how anti-Catholic that article was. And I have to tell you, in the research I did for Good Catholic Girls, Richard Seip, a Benedictine monk, I quoted his research, said 50% of Catholic priests at any one time are sexually active, 30% with women, 15% with men, and the smallest percentage with children. But so that's why I say it's theoretically a celibate hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I think that the casualties of compulsory celibacy are both adult men and women who are victims of these very exploitative priests, and children, as we've seen.
And isn't it interesting that as Pope Benedict tries to expand his market share and attract some Anglicans, he's saying that Anglican priests who are married can join the Catholic Church. He'll make an exception for them.
Right.
I just think that's remarkable at a time when Levada, the former Archbishop of San Francisco, who is the enforcer for the Vatican now under Pope Benedict, is still threatening to excommunicate Father Roy at the School of the Americas.
Yes, because, Father Roy Bourgeois, right.
Because he participated in the ordination of a woman.
Yes, yes. Well, I've been to several of those ordinations, including the first one on the Danube. Well, I wasn't at the first one on the Danube, but I've been writing about it since it began.
Mm-hmm.
All of those women have been excommunicated. And not only that, they're also throwing out women theologians, women pastoral associates, if they dare to question the church's ban on women's ordination, which a papal commission of this church basically said there are no scriptural grounds for excluding women from ordination. So to have this institution have this kind of power and moral recognition from the world at large amazes me. It truly amazes me.
Well, and I don't want to overplay the family and C Street and the bad people who've been involved there. I'm thinking of Senator Ensign and Governor
yes.
Sanford,
yes.
Because I'm a sinner too, and I try to judge not lest I be judged. At the same time, it's important to think critically here and to examine the influence of these evangelical groups. And now that they are allied with the Catholic bishops, and we've seen the defeat of what now almost 40 different measures to permit same-sex marriage, those are all driven by religious zealots. And now, after successfully pushing back on the misguided efforts to ban so-called partial birth abortion, the generally successful efforts at pushing back on parental notification measures, which were stalking horses for rollback or ultimate repeal of abortion rights, we have seen this stunning out of left field, because Stupak is nominally a Democrat, this measure that surfaced. And now we have a Hobson's choice, and that is this bill so important? Does it expand health care and help people who need it to the extent that we can accept the sharp curtailment of a woman's right to choose? And I am at the point, Angela, of saying, no, I would rather see this bill fail than see it pass with the mandates, with the bailouts for insurance companies, and no real effort to control costs, which are the real drivers for uninsured in this country. We really do, I think, reach the point here, and Stupak, as I put in my blog post, pushed us over the cliff of worse than doing nothing. Your opinion?
I agree. I appreciate how difficult a choice this is for lots of policymakers right now, but I think, that, to my mind, this amendment makes it really impossible for me to support this. And actually, two congresswomen, Diana Degette and mm-hmm. Jan Schakowsky, both have put a petition up on the web inviting that they have gotten signatures from, I don't know, over 40 lawmakers, and they're inviting people around the country to join them in signing this petition. And they basically have pretty much said that they cannot support this if this amendment is in the final, I guess it's the conference committee when they sit down to look at this bill. So,
Angela, I appreciate that, and it's true. More than 40 have signed this. And this is where we need progressives to really get tough. Because one of the things we saw with Stupak was that in late-night horse trading with the Speaker, the CAPS bill, which essentially would have just reinforced the Hyde Amendment without expanding it, it's named for Lois Capps, a former registered nurse who represents Santa Barbara and that portion of the California coastline. She's a good Democrat, a good progressive. And she had this compromise approach, which would essentially not expand any bans on abortion rights.
Right.
And that was given up, and I don't know exactly the details of those conversations, but begrudgingly, Pelosi permitted Stupak's amendment to come to the floor.
Right.
And part of the horse trading was he said, well, look, if you don't permit us to bring this amendment to the floor, then a group of blue dogs and so-called pro-life Democrats will not support the underlying bill. And what happened? They got their anti-abortion amendment, and 22 of those people voted against the bill anyway.
Right.
So we cannot rely on the wheeling and dealing that comes from these conservatives, because they will say whatever they think they need to say to hoodwink us into passing these draconian, huge steps backward. And my belief is that we need to see galvanized progressives who really do not blink and say, we will not vote for the conference report if the Stupak Amendment is in there in any way, shape, or form. And it's got to be as firm as possible. We can't have any last-minute defections.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. Completely.
So how do we do this? How do we get progressives to stand firm? After all, there were over 80 progressives who said that they wouldn't vote for a bill that didn't have a public option. And what's in there is barely, you know, resembling a public option. I believe it's designed to fail as a public option. And Kucinich is the only one of those progressives who I know who actually followed through and did not vote for this package.
People have to be vocal, all of us. You know, what you're saying is so correct. So if your listeners can call their representatives and call their local NARAL and their Planned Parenthood and just do whatever they can do to put pressure to make sure that at minimum this amendment is taken out, and also to in terms of the other issues that you're raising, to make sure there is a public option. I mean, there are so many things we lost along the way here, you're right. But, you know, if we could cover 46 million people in some way who don't have coverage now or have insufficient coverage, and if we could force these insurance companies not to close people out for pre-existing conditions, at least it would be a start. You know, I agree that it's so far from perfect. I truly wanted single-payer, universal health care,
mm-hmm.
get rid of the insurance companies. I don't understand what point, you know, why we have to keep them. But this is America.
My fear, though, Angela, is that Rahm Emanuel, who is the White House chief of staff and was the architect of the Democratic majority, bringing in the Heath Shulers. Heath Shuler lives at the C Street House, and he was a self-funded conservative Democrat. And so Pelosi's majority that her speakership is based on is wobbly because of all these dinos, Democrats in name only, who cannot be counted on the most critical issues to come through on the progressive side. And so we have fundamental problems here, and my belief is that we need to speak clearly about the defects of the bill, that we need to make clear that the abortion amendment from Stupak is a poison pill, and that we would rather see no bill at this time than a bill with Stupak.
Yes, yes. You know what else we really need, Peter? We need your listeners to run for office. You know, you look at this Congress, and you think, who are they? I mean, most Americans want a public option. Most Americans think women's reproductive health should be covered, even Catholics. You know, polls have shown this. And it's like, who do they represent? It's what you're talking about, this behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing, and then these religious influences. And, you know, we need more people representing the people to get into Congress.
Well, and fundamentally, that starts with campaign finance reform, because the reason that we have, these powerful incumbents like Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman, who've taken millions of dollars from insurance interests, and will do everything they can to maintain those loyalties at our expense. And so we need to unseat these people. And because they've gotten all that money from the very interests that they're catering to, they're primed to get reelected next time Lieberman beat Ned Lamont, a self-funded guy who put more than $10 million into that Senate race to try to defeat Lieberman, and didn't expect Lieberman to jump out of the Democratic Party to save his own ass there, but that's right. What he did.
That's right.
And then we've got to be honest and critical, too. Just for your information, I've known Nancy Pelosi for a long time. I worked as a campaign consultant for her in the 90s. But as I look at the situation right now, she's following the Emmanuel map here, where she's out every weekend at fundraisers for these Democrats in marginal districts, and her focus is maintaining power. And she's taking huge contributions herself from the very industries that she is countering in this process. And while I can't establish that it has directly corrupted her, you have to imagine that when you're taking money from healthcare lobbyists, you at least listen to their point of view, and you know that there is more money available if you yield to them.
It is a crazy system. It is a system that is so broken, so broken. You're right.
Well, before you go, Angela, let me read this quote, and we're going to discuss it with my next guest as well. But I found this at the Huffington Post. Dr. Marcia Angel wrote it. Is the House bill better than nothing? I don't think so. It simply throws more money into a dysfunctional and unsustainable system with only a few improvements at the edges, and it augments the central role of the investor-owned insurance industry. The danger is that as costs continue to rise and coverage becomes less comprehensive, people will conclude that we've tried health reform and it didn't work. But the real problem will be that we didn't really try it. I would rather see us do nothing now and have a better chance of trying again later and then doing it right. Your thoughts?
Oh, God, it's such a... I think I'd have to stay with what I said before. I just think things are so bad now for so many people. And this seems to be a country where we can only do things incrementally, at least with the system and the lawmakers that we have right now. And I guess I would have to say, let's just fight to get the best we can right now.
Okay. Well, Angela, I really appreciate your advocacy, and I want to see a real fight here by the pro-choice elements in our country and in the Democratic Party. And I will continue to push for this. But we really need to see a massive effort to speak up and make sure that we confront our own leaders and let them know that this is a deal breaker.
Absolutely.
Angela Bonavolia. You say Bonavolia, right?
Either way, actually. You said it perfectly.
Yeah, the G is silent.
The G is silent.
Great talking with you, and thanks for joining me today.
Great talking to you, Peter. Thanks so much.
Still beating? And the Peter B. Collins Show continues. Still to come, Gary Chu reviews the new movie called Pirate Radio. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link or clink on it if you like. It's on the homepage at peterbcollins.com, and there's a very special introductory offer so you can try these fine imported organic wines. Lewis in the news playing us into this segment as Dr. Len Saputo and Byron Belitzos return to the Peter B. Collins Show. They were here in August, and we sized up the prospects of meaningful health care reform this year. And, gentlemen, your predictions were pretty damn accurate. Dr. Len Saputo, welcome back.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be on your show.
Byron Belitzos, how are you today?
I'm excellent, Peter, and great to be back.
And you haven't required any hospitalization or serious medical care since I saw you last, I hope?
We haven't got that terrible swine flu yet.
Now, we're going to talk about swine flu before you guys leave today, because you've published a piece called The Infection Deception, and I want my listeners to know about it. They also should know about your book called A Return to Healing, Radical Healthcare Reform and the Future of Medicine, which we discussed on your previous visit. And I wanted to get an update because as we speak now, the House of Representatives squeaked out a bill about a week ago which I'm not very excited about. And I consider that, you know, we moved from the promise of health care reform to some minor modifications in the insurance scheme, all advantage industry, not, well, with the exception of pre-existing conditions. Now, that's a morsel that we can all get around and say, yeah, that had to go, and that's a good development. But, gosh, that could have been done in a bill, a simple one-pager.
Well, so, what would you expect, actually?
Well, you can't expect a whole lot, particularly when we have seen the kind of compromises that have occurred and the way that the Democrats, including the White House and President Obama, have permitted these industries to set the agenda, define the framing of this debate, and use their cash to, inject a lot of bullshit into this entire discussion.
Well said. Okay, but the problem really goes back to Congress. Congress is owned by the insurance industry and by Big Pharma. They're spending at least $1 million a day that we know of lobbying there.
Yeah.
So is it any surprise that the Congress that is owned by those industries is being told what to do?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I would expect. You're going to see a big, complicated bill that's going to have language in it that's hard to understand, that could be taken in different ways. It is certainly not going to be transparent. And then when you're through, you're going to have a system that is going to bolster the insurance industry and Big Pharma. There's no other way to look at it that makes any sense. The rest of it's smoke.
Yeah. Well, with this mandate that forces people to buy insurance without any regulation of prices. Now, there are subsidies for people who hit 140% of the poverty level, which is about $80,000 for a family of four. But that's a bailout for an industry that doesn't need it.
And it's going to increase their business.
Right.
So they win, we lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
We're not going to get what we want because we, the people, aren't the ones that run Congress.
Yeah.
Congress promises all kinds of good things to us when they're here and they're begging us to be reelected. And then they go to Washington, D.C., where they hold their hands out and they are filled quite graciously by the insurance industry and Big Pharma. Then they're in debt, and they forget about the people that put them in office. Then they come back, and they have their town hall meetings. We throw eggs and cabbage at them, and they wonder what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still reelected.
Well, the eggs and cabbage, though, come from people who are prompted by some of the very interests that want to prevent any meaningful reform and preserve the profit margins of both the healthcare industry and the insurance industry.
Well, they're also being thrown at by people who say, why have you gone to Congress and not represented me? And why have you represented corporate America? There are a lot of Americans who are enlightened. You know, the cultural creatives, we're not going to take that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But we are.
Yeah. Well, 70% support a public option, even though that's kind of a fuzzy concept. And a full majority support single payer. Most people, when polled, say, sure, I'd like Medicare for all. We need to beef up Medicare. We need to make sure it's financially solvent. But conceptually, that's what people want.
Well, you've defined the problem. Congress is not listening to us.
Yeah.
Because we don't have any influence on them right now.
So the answer is we should actually be writing huge checks and filling their campaign coffers like the other side does? Is that the only way to get their attention at a fundraiser?
I think the best way to do it is from the grassroots level. And to create change there that's the right change by people who are inspired about democracy and remember what happened in 1776 when our forefathers sacrificed their lives and their families, their livelihood, their property, but not their ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone to sleep at the wheel. Yeah. And what's happened is we've lost our democracy. It now owns a corporate America. So we can fight them. We'll lose because we don't have the money. We can also do things at the grassroots level that will make a big difference because it's what we want. So I would propose what Gandhi said, be the change you want to see. And I would do what Einstein said, attack this problem, not at the level at which it occurred, but at some different way. And that means you have to get back to work and do what our forefathers did. We got to go back and do grassroots democracy. We've got to get rid of these people that are doing things to us because they want the money.
Mm-hmm.
One solution I heard that I thought was pretty novel was to give everybody one term of 6 years. No re-elections,
mm-hmm.
No ability to come back and lobby. And when it turns over like that, that could change things, but you'll never see that legislation pass.
Yeah. You know, I'm a little wary of term limits because when they were talked about and imposed here in California, I said, well, you know, I want term limits for Republicans. And in particular, at the time, I wanted term limits only for Jesse Helms.
I'll second that.
And unfortunately, the way it works is, you know, we want to term out somebody else's representative while keeping the one or ones that we think are okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I prefer to allow elections to go forward and people to, you know.
Who are you going to vote for? One bad guy or the other bad guy? Because they're both on the take.
Well, that does present a real problem.
That's why, you know, we have a revolutionary crisis here. We need thorough reform, not this provision or that provision or this incremental change or that. It's just not going to do the job. Mm-hmm. And one great window on this as a journalist is looking at healthcare. And working with Len has proven to me, oh, here's yet another instance of something that's so dysfunctional that even with, you know, the very best intentions by 70% of the population, we can't really get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Len has been saying from the beginning when I met him, you'll see this legislation is not going to go anywhere. And I dragged Len to Washington so we could do some lobbying to kind of almost disprove that. You said, well, Len, let's go see what happens out there.
Mm-hmm.
And over the months, I've seen that he's right.
And you came crawling back.
And you came crawling back.
But I didn't exactly call it crawling back.
I had a little hope in my heart by, you know, August, September. And then when this swine flu thing came in, as well as all the rest, it was obvious that this is so deep and dark
mm-hmm.
that people have to look at systemic change. Soon, and I think we'll get this bill. It'll be a terrible bill, and it'll be another big wake-up call. And there'll be a new round immediately at the grassroots level.
Well, I would just challenge your assumption there, Byron, because I think we really have reached the point where progressives are going to peel off over the abortion restrictions of the Stupak Amendment, and that even if that is stripped out, I think people are coming to grips with the assessment that this bill will not cover enough Americans at a reasonable cost. It doesn't fix the fundamental problems with the double-digit increases in both the cost of health care and the insurance that we buy to protect ourselves from those escalating costs. And so it's a huge gift to the insurance industry. And I believe that before a final bill hits the Senate and House floors, that we will see an awakening. And unfortunately, you know, on a partisan basis, it plays into the hand of Republicans. It plays into the hands of those yahoos who obstructed the town hall meetings in August with gibberish. You know, they didn't have a proposal. They didn't have a counter idea. They were simply trying to block this. But I have come, regrettably, to the conclusion that doing nothing right now would actually be slightly better than passing this hodgepodge of a mess that came out of the House.
How about not as badass?
Yeah.
Okay, because let's face it, we're not addressing the real problem. We're talking about rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic as the whole system's going down. What's the real problem? We are the real problem. We are not evolved to a point in humanity that we have the social transformation that's required for us to want to do the right thing. We are trying to create legislation to force it. Change is by inspiration, not by legislation, if you've got real change. It comes from awareness. It comes from education. It comes from experience. And we can make those changes, but we have to know where we've gone wrong first. Mm-hmm. We've got to do something to change that system.
Yeah. Well, and we have a real problem because we rely on a corporatized media to give us information and to advocate for us in some way, shape, or form. I mean, we're not naive that we think General Electric, even though they have Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann on MSNBC, wants to, for example, reduce the cost of medical appliances, one of the big profit centers at General Electric.
Yeah,
I have no illusions about that. At the same time, the kind of systemic change that you describe is really hard to achieve in this country, because we are so marginalized, and it starts with campaign finance,
that
we can't buy the same level of influence that these corporations can.
Really,
and we
doesn't.
Never will, and we shouldn't be fighting it. What we should be doing is staying outside the system completely. I have always done that throughout my career in medicine. I have never been affiliated with the mainstream. This is an outside movement that's grassroots-driven, and it's a new change. It's a new social transformation. We got to start over again because this system is not repairable. You got to go beyond the system, as Einstein said, and find a new way of dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
Grassroots thinking can do that. The people who are the cultural creators, if they will get their, you know, roll up their sleeves and put a little elbow grease into this thing and participate in democracy, there's no way it can fail.
Yeah.
Because once you become the change you want to see, you've got the power of the people behind you. If you fight against the money, which you don't have compared to what big business does, you're dead in your tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a fight. It's a change in thinking. It's a new social transformation, and it's a willingness to participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're missing.
Now, abortion as a policy issue has charged the verb to abort. But abort doesn't only refer to reproduction. And I believe we have reached a point where it's time to push the abort button on this particular round of so-called health care reform.
Well, you know, Kucinich said it best this week, that it's better to not have this bill and for the bill to fail than for this bill to pass and to institutionalize a corporate bailout, in particularly for insurance, but for everybody else in the allopathic system, they're going to get everything they want and more. So, yeah, I mean, my feeling at the moment, Peter, is I do slightly disagree with you. I think that Obama must get this signed. He'll do just about anything. There'll be some sort of bill. I agree.
There will be some sort of a bill.
Some sort of bill.
I think that it won't even resemble what we're talking about today.
Yeah, it'll be worse.
Maybe a token.
You know, and the Progressive Caucus may bolt, and mm-hmm. they'll have to, you know, hang, you know, just nail them somehow with some deal to get them to vote. Maybe they will. But I feel, though, Obama has the political chops to get something and then claim he got somewhere. Because if he doesn't, it's going to be real bad for him politically. So, I don't know.
But the converse is true, too, that if a botched bill passes, it becomes fodder for both progressives and conservatives to attack the incumbents next year.
Yep.
So they get a shrinking majority in the House. They may lose a few seats in the Senate and make that a filibuster zone. And then you have the prospect that Obama, whether he's a one-termer or two-termer, will be like Bill Clinton, that he can only do incremental things because he will not have Democratic majorities to work with.
Boy.
And at the same time, we see Rahm Emanuel and Nancy Pelosi out there trying to preserve Democrats who are voting against these measures, who are in swing districts that could go Republican. And so a lot of those people were permitted in the House, like Heath Shuler, for example, a freshman, self-funded conservadem who Rahm Emanuel recruited. And he is an example of the very wobbly majority that Pelosi's speakership is based on. Now, Shuler was permitted by the authorities to vote against this in order to try to hold on to his seat next year.
Oh, yeah.
And at the same time, Pelosi is out holding fundraisers for these same conservative and blue dog Democrats, where pharma and the health insurance lobby and the HMOs are plunking down tens of thousands of dollars in cash. Now, this is a whole formula for a big train wreck. In too many respects.
Listen, if you want to fight, that's the way to go about it. But I don't think it's the right way to go about it. I think you have to have new kind of thinking, new kind of people who are committed to make change, who are willing to fight for the democracy again. And that's where the effort should be. I can't see rearranging chairs on the deck of the Titanic. And that's what's still happening.
Mm-hmm.
I want a new approach.
And the other thing, of course, as we explain in our book, A Return to Healing, there needs to be a new paradigm of medicine. We're not even getting into that in this discussion so far.
No, we're not touching. Well, but the whole reform effort isn't touching on
that.
Any changes in the delivery of health care.
No, it's all
just
economics.
About how we pay for it.
It's about
paradigm,
who's going to get what.
The science is not being touched. The paradigm issues, the many, many, many important discoveries in natural healing that have come out in the last generation, none of this stuff is going to be institutionalized. It's still being excluded and marginalized. And that's why, you know, we got a double whammy here to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
A bad bill, even for allopathic medicine, not to mention the new paradigm medicine, which will be what everyone will be doing in 30 years.
Yeah. Well, our friends over at Healthcare Now have prepared a very succinct list here about what is in the House bill and where it really leaves us. And it's written here, what the Democrats fail to mention is the bill leaves millions of people uninsured, allows medical bankruptcies to persist, criminalizes and fines the uninsured, increases the number of underinsured, does nothing to contain the skyrocketing costs, blocks women from reproductive rights, transfers massive public funds to private insurance companies, strengthening their control over the delivery, protects pharmaceutical companies' super profits at patient expense, fails to reclaim the 31% of waste in our system, expands Medicaid without regard to states' ability to pay, and there are four states that have a sweetheart deal, including Harry Reid's Nevada, where he's up for re-election next year, where the federal government is going to pick up all of their Medicaid costs for a certain period of time. I think it's the next 4 years.
Isn't I'm beginning that... to think, Peter, you think this is a bad deal.
I do. I'm not finished yet. Discriminates based on immigration status and age, sets up several levels of care covering less for those without the ability to pay. Those who have coverage will increasingly find it unaffordable and will go without. And one of the things that I see is in this minuscule so-called public option that they have created, it's clearly designed to fail. Yeah. It can't work. It is a plan that will permit those who aren't able to get insurance through other means to enter a small pool, a very small pool that has to be unsubsidized. They say they're going to put a little seed money in there, and then it's got to work on its own. Well, these will be the people who can't qualify for coverage elsewhere, who are highest risk, highest users of health care, and that it just undermines the whole idea of trying to expand the risk pool so that everyone's covered. And that ultimately would bring the cost down for all those who are in that pool.
You sound disappointed.
Well, I am. I wanted better coverage because
well, what
every
would you
year,
expect?
Mine goes up. I pay more and I get less.
Here are the problems. All right, we've already said it. Congress is corrupt. They're in the hands of big pharma and the insurance industry. You can't expect anything that's going to provide a disadvantage to them and an advantage to us. So that's a done deal. It's mm-hmm. not going
to
work.
That's why we've come here to bring healing for you, Peter.
Well, I think I need it. I certainly need it. Now, here is that ultra-liberal Rupert Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal with statistics out here on Friday the 13th saying that currently we have 54 million uninsured, okay, and about 8 to 10 million of those are non-citizens. Under the House bill, 18 million... about 10 million citizens, would remain without coverage. And that's an optimistic assessment because, of course, without any cost control, this is a projection, not a fact. And under the Baucus bill in the Senate, 25 million people would remain uninsured. So when we look at this from these different angles, I really do conclude that this is a lose-lose proposition. And that even though it'll hurt Obama politically and could have ramifications for the Democrats, we can't allow short-term political issues or considerations to influence what is a very long-term process. And if this package passes, it will make things worse, not better.
Well, nobody's trying to solve the problem. They're trying to resolve all the problems that go with it, all the criticism. I mean, common sense will tell you if you've got 47 million Americans that are uninsured, and you suddenly insure those people, you're going to put a burden that's going to be expensive on the rest of the system. And if you're not going to put another dime, okay, into the system, as Barack Obama promised, what the hell do you think is going to happen with health care? It's going to be diluted. You're not going to have Medicare for all. Fact is, you're not going to have Medicare at all when you're through because you're taking away a lot of the services that are provided there. People are going to have something like Medicaid for everybody. Now, you show me one person, just one, who's really happy with Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Just one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with a provider like you. Do you take Medicaid patient? It's called Medi-Cal here in California.
I wouldn't get near it. But mm-hmm. I'll tell you what I do is I treat a lot of people for free
uh-huh.
or on a sliding scale.
And that's better than using Medi-Cal?
Way better.
And why? Tell us.
Well, philosophically, it's the wrong thing to do. I don't want to support that system. It's not really supporting any. I mean, this is terrible care for the poor is what it's about. It's the class separation that just continues to go on. We've got to give these people real care, and I can do that, and I will. I don't deprive anybody services that I can provide they can't get someplace else. which is probably why I don't make any money. But, you know, that's because I'm a little bit different than a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm into providing the service. And if we were all that way and we became the change we wanted to see, we wouldn't have any problems. All these people that are corrupt wouldn't be an issue. They'd be gone because America would be back in the hands of the people, the good people.
Yeah. Byron?
As far as those millions, they'll have the FEMA camps, and FEMA camps provide, you know, some kind of health care, and that's a good place perhaps to get it. It'd probably be like Medicaid. It might be the public option.
Yeah.
You could get the public option in the FEMA camps.
Right, you can go to a FEMA camp.
Would I get a
care,
FEMA trailer with ammonium?
Or yeah, it's
is
optional.
That optional.
Yeah,
it's
you
an
get
option.
What you want.
You know,
upgrade.
They
if
do
you
have
request
options.
It, you can have it.
Yeah, right. You know, if you're a good citizen. That's what I say. I mean, this T.R. Reid, as you may know, wrote this book on sickness around the world. And his show was back on PBS this week, and I happened to see it again. And it was a reminder of what these other countries do. And I don't know if you've talked about it on your programs. But every single country he goes to, he says, oh, by the way, how many people do you have that are going bankrupt because of their medical bills? You know, he's ready to hear, you know, millions and percentages. And every single one of them looked at him like, you're crazy.
Yeah, right.
Not one person in our country. He was in Japan. He was in Switzerland, Germany. Mm-hmm. Not one medical bankruptcy. We are so far away from anything like that. We're in a different planet from these other, almost every other country.
Here's a question
and that's
for you.
That's the question is, why are we this island of corruption when you look at these other places that are fairly corrupt? I mean,
perfect.
You know, Germany, Japan. I mean, Japan's got the Yakuza. I mean, they've got – why do they – how did they manage to get everyone covered in that country at one-third the price in the United States, and as we show in the book? I mean, it's, and better care and better longevity and better infant mortality. Ask yourself that. I mean, that's why Len and I continually say – the system is it's so out of whack. When you look at these other places, even African countries almost, you can't really reform this unless you had a massive social change of the kind Martin Luther King was talking about.
Exactly.
So I can reduce this to one sentence.
Okay.
The for-profit delivery of health care is a failure.
Right.
Yes. That's the idea.
And until we can recognize that stark reality, and as long as we keep listening to all this free market hoo-ha, and it's filtered through the corporate media with the, you know, the drug commercials for restless leg syndrome interspersed, you know, we're going to be stuck with this. Until we understand that the so-called market delivery will not work and will not get us where we want to go, then we really are just rearranging the most expensive deck chairs on the
very
Titanic.
Good plush chairs.
Yeah, well, don't limit it to health care. I mean, we failed in every area of our culture. We failed in real business. We don't have community business. We got business for profit that makes a lot of people suffer. We haven't done it in law. We haven't done it in medicine. We haven't done it in science. We haven't done it in religion. Religion may be the worst, as a matter of fact. We failed across the board. And until we have a social transformation of humanity to a higher level, we are doomed to this kind of fundamentalistic approach that's fatally flawed.
Mm-hmm.
We may sound like we're evading some of the questions about health, you know, current events and healthcare reform, but I think the window on why we need such drastic change, one of the best windows I've seen is medicine and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
It is so dysfunctional, even compared to the banking system.
Right.
You know, people's lives are at stake, and they still can't fix the fundamentals of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to also add about, you know, just on the economics of this. In Germany, I was really amazed at the PBS documentary. They interviewed, T.R. Reid interviews CEO of one of the healthcare insurance providers, one of the big ones, a real corporate-looking guy. He says, we're not permitted to make a profit. We are regulated. We are not, however, we're highly competitive. We have 18 competitors, all of them nonprofit. We offer very special deals. We love to serve our you know, and he's a real corporate guy with pinstripe suit on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do in Germany. And everyone loves the system in Germany. And those countries, they're nonprofit insurers, but there's competition and innovation in a nonprofit delivery system.
Well, we should rename this package as the, you know, competition prevention in the healthcare industry bill. We have to come up with a good acronym for it.
But I like it. That's right.
Now, before I want to move on to your new document here about the swine flu so-called pandemic, is there anything else either of you want to say about the so-called healthcare reform and what our listeners should be looking for and who they should be looking to for leadership?
They need to get off their asses, first of all, their fat asses, because that's what's happened in this country, and start taking responsibility for their own health care in a prevention model, which they can do. And they need to go back to the grassroots and do what our forefathers did in 1776 and bring democracy back to this country. That means elbow grease. You got to start participating in public programs. And if you'll do that, there's no way to fail. But it's not just about talk. It's about action.
Mm-hmm. And I would add that there is a systemic solution to this. And when we see this bill, it will remind everybody with a huge shock that they need to get a vision for a massive change in healthcare and medicine. And we can hit the ground running as soon as this bill, this failed bill, is signed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I'll be right back, guys. I got to wash my hands. Because I shook hands with each of you as you came in,
yes.
And you're obviously carrying H1N1.
Well, we shook hands with other people. That's right. We did that today.
Yeah.
You know, watch my elbow. I sneezed into it.
So you have published a piece here that is fully footnoted. It's called The Infection Deception, Unanswered Questions About the Swine Flu Controversy. And I've read it. And it is stunning because, and with your permission, I would like to post a link to this document with the show file at peterbcollins.com.
Certainly, man.
So people can read this for themselves.
Great.
But what you've done is, in a detailed and methodical way, taken a look at the media reports and the official statements that have been put out by our Center for Disease Control, Centers for, I guess it is now, CDC, and the World Health Organization, the WHO. And first, Dr. Len Saputo, talk a little bit about the big picture here, about the numbers that have been parlayed into the media, and what the real stats are, and how those are being collected.
Well, there's a lot of deception here, and that's why this article is titled that. We know that there's an epidemic, that we know there's a pandemic. But the criteria that define what a pandemic is has been changed, and conveniently just about a month before all this happened. So the World Health Organization originally said a pandemic is something that causes widespread disease in multiple countries and in incidences that are far above what's usual and have a mortality and a morbidity that's worrisome. They conveniently left that out because what we're tracking is a cold. Okay, people die from colds. We need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
The actual number of deaths that have occurred from the swine flu, you know what? Nobody really knows. Although I think the people that have come the closest are the people from CBS News, not the CDC.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they went ahead and they asked the CDC for the stats on the prevalence of this disease in the United States, they flat turned them down, said no. They even tried legal maneuvers, and they still would not give them the information, and they had no comment to make on it. So CBS did the study themselves, went to each state and said, hey, you're still doing the testing, even though the government told you it was no longer necessary, because back in June...
And explain that.
Yeah, because back in June, what had happened is there was so much of flu going around that they just made the assumption that everything that was out there was swine flu, because for a short time that was true. But when they went back and got the information from the states who were still collecting this information and looking at large numbers of people and seeing how many of them had the swine flu, that number was varying between 2 and about 17% was swine flu compared to other colds and flus and illnesses like the adenoviruses and the respiratory syncytial mm-hmm. virus, et cetera, et cetera. So what's going on? Why is this information concealed? Why is it an outright lie? What's the CDC trying to do? What's WHO trying to do?
Well, and the CDC can't even really keep tabs on its own statistics because they've wobbled all over the place. And again, quoting my favorite liberal rag, the Wall Street Journal, okay, they published a story here on November 13th saying that the total number of deaths in the United States is, I think, 3,900.
Uh-huh.
But the official number from the CDC inexplicably jumped from 1,615 to 4,000 on November 11th.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so, when we at least 100 people are missing.
missing in action.
And maybe more.
Yeah, right.
Well, FEMA camp, don't forget. we were working on this in midweek, and, well, we're just about done with this thing. And you know, I'm going through and editing. And then I see this note, this email, that they've upped it from 1,600 to 4,000 overnight. And it was, and they said, as reported in the New York Times,
yeah, right.
It's now gone from 1,600 to 4,000, right? New York Times didn't actually report. They released it simultaneously to the media, and they used the name New York Times to give legitimacy to the announcement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you go to the New York Times, there isn't anything behind this story. There wasn't any until today, I believe, that they gave any background. So they just upped it arbitrarily, tripled it. And we were showing in our – it was right when we were working on the numbers and how they're fudging the numbers. And as if they were trying to prove our point, they tripled the mortality rate.
I'll tell you, even if they triple it, it's not that many people. When you're talking about deaths usually from a pneumonia, you know how many deaths there are every year from swine flu? Or we got – well, I mean from influenza.
Right.
Yeah, they say 36,000. And everybody gets all excited about that. We know that number's inflated, but you know how many deaths there are worldwide from pneumonia? Try 2.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we futzing around with little numbers like this with a vaccine that even on the package insert from the vaccine company says, we have no evidence this will protect you from swine flu? Now, the CDC's not stupid. They can count from 1 to 100. They can count, I'll bet, to 1 to 10,000 if mm-hmm. they try hard.
Yeah.
I trust they can. But what they're telling us is something different all the time. They keep upping the ante, trying to say that this is a serious disease. You should be scared to death. And when you turn on your TV set, you see these poor people in ICU who are on all tubes in every orifice, blood mm-hmm. all over the place, saying, do you want to be like this and you want this to happen to your kids? Well, that's just nonsense.
And most of those people who are getting a serious or even fatal dose of this have underlying medical conditions that
Absolutely.
Compromise their immune systems and their ability to take on an infection.
And they're the least likely to benefit from the vaccine. What's the best way to get immunity from the flu? Get the bloody flu.
So should we, instead of wearing a little tag that says, I got inoculated,
yeah.
should we say, I've already had the flu,
yeah,
I'm healthier than you?
They'll find a way to get you to take it yet, because it makes no sense. Why, for an infection that's not that lethal, that's not any longer that prevalent, is it necessary for the president to make a mandate that's extending the Patriot Act to cause martial law to come into effect if it's necessary, when it would be very easy just for him to make a proclamation and say, we got to work better with our hospitals? Some doesn't make any sense to me, and I'm starting to get worried about some of these conspiracy theories that are out there.
Len, what is the purpose, the practical impact of the president declaring a health emergency? This never happened. Well, I guess
it hasn't
Ford
in 60 years.
Didn't Ford declare an emergency with the swine flu in 75?
Boy, it's getting to be a habit with swine flu.
Yeah,
76. Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. And look what
that.
Happened there. That was a total disaster. I mean, we had one death from the flu, 25 from the vaccine, and 4,000 people making claims because they'd been disabled from it. Something wrong with this picture.
Yeah.
It has to make some sense. It doesn't on the surface. And why would they lie to us? Why would there have to be all this information that is accelerated to try and convince us we need to take it? And it wouldn't be just for money for Big Pharma, because they've already paid Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that. It's got to be something else.
So you cite in your article that the official CDC number of deaths in the United States has reached 4,000. They don't offer a specific estimate of the number of people infected, but the six-month U.S. tally here in the Wall Street Journal today, headline reads, swine flu sickens 22 million, an estimated 22 million. Now, when we take that number based on estimates into account with the fact that since August, the policy has been not to test people who present with symptoms that could be swine flu,
right,
and simply to assume that anybody who's got some of these symptoms has swine flu, then we're not dealing with real numbers. We're
right.
dealing with a bunch of guesstimates, and they seem to be, some guy sitting there with his finger on the calculator,
I'm
just
not
hitting
sure
multiply.
That's where his finger
multiply,
is.
Multiply. Well, maybe it's just been somewhere else.
Well, even if you look at the fact that possibly 22 million is right, if there are 4,000 deaths,
that's a pretty low mortality rate.
That's good news.
That's right.
And the better news is we got 22 million people now immunized with something that's going to last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they got cellular immunity and they've got antibody immunity, and that is not what you get from any vaccine.
So let's put some specifics on this. In California, CBS found that there were 13,704 test samples from suspected swine flu patients. 86% were negative for any kind of flu, not just H1N1.
Gee whiz.
In Georgia, home of the CDC, state labs analyzed 3,117 test samples. 2% were positive for swine flu. In Florida, 8,800 test samples, 17% positive. So there are variances, but they are still at relatively low levels.
Look, the epidemic's over. It's on the tail down. They're scaring the hell out of us. There wasn't any big deal in the Southern Hemisphere in the wintertime that they had down there. It was a mild flu. It was like a cold. Like I said, we're tracking a cold all around the world and all across the U.S. We're freaking people out. We're withholding information, and we're trying to convince everybody they need to take this flu vaccine. Peter, I don't understand it. Do you?
I don't. And I have, I think I've only had one flu shot in my whole life. And I, you know, I'm fairly healthy, so.
I've had none.
It doesn't occur to me to get one. Byron, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to add that the numbers you just read off, which came out from CBS News, 3-month investigation, a major rigorous investigation. In researching for this piece, I noticed that nobody quotes that piece. Not anywhere that I can find. For 2 weeks now, we've been looking. I wanted to see how anybody else would analyze the CBS News numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And barely anybody in the mainstream press picked up from CBS News.
Yeah. What is that about?
It's about the fact that they're listening to the government numbers
mm-hmm.
and letting it have preponderance. And there's nobody else, even in the mainstream media, that wants to quote this major investigation, which has the definitive numbers arrived at by investigative reporting. So it's a commentary on what's happening in this other sphere,
mm-hmm.
you know, of our culture.
Yeah,
we are not even, you know, CBS and Atlantic Monthly, by the way, which we should talk about. Some of the mainstream is beginning to get hip to the scene. But we're so wobbly, we're so knocked out by these propaganda numbers that people aren't using that research.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Yeah. Well, and you point out in this article that 100,000 people in the United States die every year from adverse prescriptions. The wrong drugs are prescribed. Total number of deaths from medically caused damage, somewhere between 200,000 and a million.
It's closer to a million. Read the article by Gary Null called Death by Medicine that's referenced with over 200 mainstream references. It's over 900,000 people.
Wow.
400,000 from drugs. 100,000 people in the hospital with the expected side effects of medications are dying to the tune of 106,000 people. That doesn't even count the people outside the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to do something to make health care better and have some kind of presidential note of it and some kind of martial law, let's start looking at that
mm-hmm.
rather than these puny little things with the swine flu. Not that I think one single death is a good idea, but you can't solve that with a solution that isn't one that's proven and that has a track record of being problematic, that you know is going to cause problems.
Len, at the risk of appearing to contradict you, the people who are best immunized through this process are the companies making the vaccines. Because by an act of Congress, they have been relieved of any liability for lawsuits, unless I guess we have to prove that they put blacktop in my vaccine, right? Or I don't know, some other toxic chemical.
Talk to a woman named Burgermeister from Austria. See what she has to say. That's going to be in part two of this thing.
Yeah.
Scary, scary stuff,
mm-hmm.
if she's right.
Now, Byron, what about the way they've been cracking down on alternative medicine and herbal remedies who make claims not that they are specifically, used to respond to H1N1, but they make broad claims that this will boost your immunity and help you avoid the flu and colds and things like that.
They do have to connect with – they connected to H1N1 somewhere on their website in every case. It looked like, you know, in some cases maybe not. I couldn't go through all 70 of them, but in most cases. But it's interesting to see that these dark purveyors of vitamin D even got away with it as long as they did. Aren't we glad that they came down on these people who were putting out herbs to the population? How could they do such a thing? How could they be talking about boosting our immunity with substances that have no side effects?
Well, if they'd operate on Wall Street, we'd get them some bailouts.
So, I mean, this is the irony, you know, and we have a bit of a scoop here in this article that we did find this. Of course, we noticed it because Andrew Weil was the hammer came down on him, and he's a celebrity in the eye of everybody. And then when we looked online, we found that everybody you can imagine, you know, just the corner herbal store, more or less, was sent a warning letter with very heavy legal language telling him to cease and desist talking about boosting immunity to prevent H1N1 virus. It's a scandal, really.
Mm-hmm. So, Len, in your medical opinion, you've been practicing medicine for 30-plus years now.
Thank you. Actually, a little longer, but that's kind.
Is there ever a benefit from a flu vaccine? Are there certain vulnerable people where the benefits outweigh the risks? Or, in your opinion, is the whole vaccine concept a scam?
Well, I don't,
specific to the flu. I'm
okay,
certainly not trying to generalize about all illnesses.
Well, you actually could, but let's do it that way. There's no data to support that this is going to work. This is a hypothesis. We don't have any clinical trials that are real clinical trials. There's a fellow named Tom Jefferson who's done a lot of work in this and researched it, who works with the Institute of Medicine, so it's not like some flake guy. And he thinks that that the data on this is just awful. Until I see data that's clear, I'm not going to recommend that for myself or my family or for my patients or my colleagues or anybody else. I think we ought to be dealing with good, solid science, and we're not. And until we have that, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
That's just it, that the data, that is, the research has not been done, it never has been done, and they say it's unethical to do the research because we've got to vaccinate everybody right now. We can't have a control group that's not vaccinated. That would be unethical. And the top researcher in the world, this guy Jefferson, is saying at these conferences, and you know he's marginalized now, even though he's a top research scientist in the world on flu vaccines in particular. He's saying, you know, you people are unethical because you're not doing double-blind placebo-controlled studies. You never have, and apparently you never will. And therefore, you know, the upshot, and this is in Atlantic Monthly, which everybody should read this month, the upshot is that there's no science backing what the WHO and CDC is pushing down our throat, but there is science backing the use of herbal remedies, homeopathy, and all the things that Len talks about that are the solution, and it's being withdrawn from the population. Ask yourself, why do that?
That's right. I agree with you. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. We ought to be scientific. It's the same thing that happens repeatedly in medicine. Same thing with the radical mastectomy for breast cancer. I mean, for 75 years, a guy named Halsted came up initially with this idea that if you have a cancer, the more you take out, the better the chance for cure. And he was taking out the breast, the tissues under the breast, the muscles, sometimes the ribs, and sometimes the whole quadrant, including the arm. Well, 75 years later, they find out if you do a lumpectomy, the outcome's the same, and insisting that was the only thing to do. Mm-hmm. So we have these kinds of examples punctuated throughout our history. There are real problems. It's the same thing in cancer treatments. They always compare one treatment to another. There is never a control where you've got one group that's getting the treatment and another group that's not getting the treatment, and then following them over time and seeing what happens. It's assumed that if you don't do that, it's unethical. But I would purport that it's unethical to do what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, as I'm listening to your comments about this and thinking about the context of it, I'm really struck by the way Guantanamo and the field manual there infused new language. And they had a concept there called fear up. And that was you take a prisoner and you turn up the fear. And this is a kind of a psychological tactic. And in true military style, they come up with this jargon. But aren't we being feared up unnecessarily and irresponsibly over this H1N1? And we have to look at, well, who benefits? Well, a handful of companies that have the franchise to create this vaccine, and then the entire delivery system, the healthcare delivery system, does get something out of it. But it is hard to reconcile, because I don't think of our current administration as one that wants to intentionally fear us up.
Well, it cannot be that simple. It cannot be that simple. Because we know that the vaccine people who have made, okay, this product, these products, have been reimbursed already. That's paid for. The government's paid for it. So you have, you're entitled to that vaccine if you want it. It's yours at no cost now because you've already paid for it. So it's not about economics to them. What are you left with now? How do you put this together? It doesn't make any sense. The transparency that we've been offered is incomplete. We've been lied to. Now we can't have trust. And it begins to make you wonder about what is the government got up its sleeve? Mm-hmm. What are they trying to do that they're not telling us? And I begin to read some of these conspiracy theories, and as outrageous as they sound, they are within the realm of possibility. And we have to begin to take note of things like that until somebody comes clean and tells us the damn truth.
Yeah. Byron, do you have reservations at the FEMA camp?
I'm, it's a king bed.
Can I use my miles? The airline won't take them. So.
Yeah, right.
More the merrier. We'll party down.
We'll have a party, right. We'll have our own oven.
We've been talking with Len Saputo and Byron Belitsos. The Infection Deception. You can find it on my website at peterbcollins.com. And have you posted this on?
It's on our blog, returntohealing.com/blog.
Okay, great. And their book, again, is A Return to Healing, Radical Healthcare Reform and the Future of Medicine. Gentlemen, thank you for the reality check.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, Gary Chu reviews Pirate Radio.
Interrupting all programs. Radio comes from pirate satellite, orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is radio comes from pirate satellite.
Oh yeah. And it just gives me a chance to try out one of my favorite songs by The Clash. And this song, Radio Clash, refers to the pirate stations that operated off the coast of England for many years in the 1970s and 1980s. And there's a new film out called Pirate Radio. Gary Chu has seen it. He's our official film reviewer here at the Peter B. Collins Show. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Peter B. How are you?
I'm fine. And we should amplify just a little bit on your bio that Gary was a longtime TV and radio personality in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, and where the website is where you can read the review, too.
TulsaTVMemories.com.
Right on cue.
And that makes more sense when you understand Gary's history. And, Gary, were you run out of town by some disaffected Oral Roberts students? Or exactly
no,
what happened there?
No. You could have made that question a lot more difficult if you'd have had more to it. No, actually, I didn't. I decided it was time to move around in public radio for a while, so I started moving around doing some of that and helping get some radio stations on the air in public radio, as well as the one in Tulsa before I left, and then the public TV for a while.
But, mm-hmm.
So that, and then it finally got me here to where I am now on the phone with you today in Sacramento.
Now, is there a plaque in the men's room at that public radio station in Tulsa commemorating your contributions?
Yeah, I think that's the only place they would put it. Oh, boy.
There's a guy who worked in San Francisco for years, a very clever, funny man named Bill Moen, M-O-E-N. Mm-hmm. And he's the kind of guy who had these jokes that he had been telling for years. And they always worked. I mean, they were as old as the hills, but always very funny. And he said, yeah, went into the boss and said, I want a raise. And he said, well, Gary, or Bill, I can't give you a raise, but I'll give you your own office. And he said, really? And he took him down the hall and said, yeah, we're going to add an O to the name on the men's room door.
Oh, boy. I can see how that joke would last over and over and over again through the years.
Well, he's worked it, and he got as much mileage out of that as he could. I think Bill did about 25 years on an elevator music in San Francisco before the crash of elevator music.
Oh, dear. I wonder how he stayed awake.
I think it was counting the cash that they paid him.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe that story he tells about the new office for him with the O after the M-E-N is probably true.
I think it was.
Knowing some of the bosses I've worked for.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful people in radio.
Yes, yes, yes.
So tell us about pirate radio, and in particular, I'm a fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman. That guy's a great actor.
Yeah, well, actually, he kind of phones it in on this one.
Does
he? This is not really a great movie, but I guess you would say for people like you and me, it's one you want to see because you want to see what Hollywood, or actually it's an English film, what they're going to do with something that really happened in radio back starting in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I worked with a guy in Tulsa at three different radio stations who had been at the BBC years and years ago and worked at Radio Luxembourg.
Oh.
And who was on, Britain Radio, I think it was called The Ship, and he also was on Radio Caroline for
yeah.
a while.
Well, Radio Luxembourg was actually a legal station that beamed into England, if I have this correct. And then Radio Caroline was one of the first illegal stations that was based mm-hmm. on a ship. And
right.
all of this, of course, was to feed top 40 formats, American-style rock radio, to the British people because the BBC owns and controls, it's changed now, there's some private radio in London, mm-hmm. but for the most part, broadcasting is tightly controlled by the government in England. And while the BBC Radio 1 or Radio 2 had Top of the Pops and did play the Kinks and, you know, music like that over the years, many people felt that there was no room for album rock, there was no room for oldies formats. And so there was a real demand for the kind of radio that was served up from these pirate ships.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the review that I write, and one of the reasons that I was interested in seeing this film is because I've kind of worked both sides of that street, so to speak, because in Tulsa back in the mid-70s and late 70s, I was politically fighting to get public radio on in northeastern Oklahoma, as we all know, a very... very conservative part.
The buckle of the Bible Belt.
Pardon me?
That's one of the buckles of the Bible Belt.
It's a buckle. And you've got Tom Coburn living down there and voting against the vets and all.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was fighting to get public radio on and fighting commercial broadcasters. And this movie shows commercial broadcasters fighting a big royal-type government, you know, that's been entrenched for how long,
mm-hmm.
And so I can see both sides of the argument and can understand why there ought to be both.
Yeah,
which was what I always said, you know. And so I really sort of enjoy this. And Gary Kemp, the guy I'm talking about, who was on Radio Caroline, is a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I think he lives in Missouri somewhere now. I don't know what he's doing. He's not very young these days.
Yeah,
he's older than I am.
Uh-huh.
He really had took a different political tact when we first met each other because his experience in broadcasting had been different. He was fighting the big government so we could do some commercial radio, and I was sort of fighting the commercial radio people here in the States to get non-commercial radio on.
You mean government radio, like government-run health care that'll ruin everything.
Yes, right, yeah. And NPR is so government-run, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I found a real affinity for the film. The film is like a sitcom, Peter B., kind of, you know, it's got some funny shtick that goes on, mainly sexual content. The guy who directed the film, I consider the movies he's made not to be exceedingly heavyweight films, but Philip Seymour Hoffman is a neat guy to see as a kind of a disheveled-looking American jock who's on a ship in the English North Sea.
Mm-hmm.
who was doing his thing and kind of leading these stodgy Brit jock guys around, you know, and then they bring groupies on the ship and they have little escapades with the ladies and stuff like that. So it's kind of, it could be made into a sitcom, actually. Mm-hmm. Probably do better on the BBC than it would on HBO, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I had a friend, David Cheney, who worked for about a year and a half on one of the pirate ships called Laser 558.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was relieved of my responsibilities on a morning show in San Francisco, the guy who was running that, an American named John Catlett, who had been my boss at an FM station in Chicago a few years before that, he rang me up and said, "Peter, would you like to work on Laser 558? And he said, you work 10 days on and you get 4 days off. And that's a pretty standard British fortnight structure of employment.
It's not too bad.
And he said, when you finish your last day, we helicopter you to either Dublin or London. And we have a crash pad where you can stay. And the one thing that was made very clear to me was that you could have as many girls as you wanted at the crash pad, but no girls were allowed on the ship. So the only groupies you could have had to be really strong swimmers."
Well, actually, in the movie Pirates, Radio, they actually boat them out in little tugboats.
Oh, do they?
Sure, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And even one of them happens to be, what's her name? I'm forgetting her name now. The gal who played in Angels in America that I wrote the review about. Anyway, she's a famous actress. She was married to Richard Branagh, who plays the stick-in-the-mud bureaucrat.
Uh-huh.
And she plays this kid's mother. And she doesn't get any credit in the film, but she has just a little cameo, and she kind of fancies the film up a little bit, along with Seymour Hoffman and Bill Nighy, who plays the station manager and ship's captain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a pretty good little cast, but it's really sitcom-ish. And I think it's probably for people who know nothing or very little about radio, who want just to go out and have a nice kind of a nutty date movie to watch with their girlfriend or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah. Emma Thompson is the name you were looking
for. Thank you very much. Your name wouldn't come to me there.
Yeah,
that does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Emma Thompson is the gal, and she has a short. And she, of course, she's very good, and she's a very rollicking type lady in the film, so everybody seems to be having a pretty good time. So when you're talking about the crash pad at either Dublin or London,
mm-hmm.
and you could have as many friends come by as you wanted, sounds about right, except they were doing it on the boat in the film. It's a pretty funny movie, but it's pretty lightweight.
Yeah. Well, that means that it's not going to last very long in its wide rollout, and I better go see it this weekend if I'm going to see it before it goes on DVD.
What's crazy is I've got my TV on right in front of me right now with the audio off, and they're running a commercial for Pirate Radio as we speak, and
uh-huh.
there goes Hoffman jumping off the mast into the North Sea.
So is this a case where they're trying to get the advertising and the hype out there before the bad reviews hit?
Oh, you mean on the film?
Yeah. Is that the marketing strategy of the studio,
yeah,
do you think?
I think they're appealing for, you know, a party time audience, you know, and that's what these guys do in the film. But I guess if you're into the music, actually some of the music doesn't match with the time, but it's okay. You know, there's the Kinks and the Who and the Stones. And even, I think I mentioned this in my written version, is that there's even a little segment of Herb Alpert singing "This Guy's in Love with You," that Burt Bacharach song that came out back in the 60s or I don't know.
Sure, it was in the mid 60s, yeah.
And maybe that one was right, but anyway, it was kind of funny to hear Herb Alpert singing on the soundtrack. So it's all, and you hear some really good rock music, and also being in radio, you will appreciate how the music is edited to the visual.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah,
you know. When you're in rock radio and you know you're into things being cut well and
mm-hmm.
and the film is cut quite well too.
Now, what about and this is way inside, but since we've worked in radio booths, when you see them on television and in movies, usually they don't get it right.
That's
you know,
true.
The clocks don't look right, and the you know you push a button and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was just maddening for me to watch WKRP.
Oh, yeah.
Because when Venus Flytrap was in the studio, he never used his headphones. He didn't cue up the record properly. I mean, none of that was accurate. What about here in pirate radio?
It's a little bit better, but it's not as good as it ought to be. The equipment that they have in the shipboard control room, I think for the time, looks pretty good. And you see some racks and stuff in the background, and they're not playing CDs. They're playing LPs and stuff like that. And so it looks pretty good. I thought they could have done a little bit more in terms of what you said would be little catastrophes that radio stations have from time to time, like, you know, some sort of an electronic problem or something like that, or a power problem, or even some jokes about the selling commercials, because they could have emphasized the commercial end of it more, because that was the point of the conflict, if they were commercial and illegal, and the British government didn't want them to do it.
Yeah.
And my friend Gary Kemp even mentioned to me, I think he mentioned it in the sidebar he wrote for my review on Tulsa TV Memories, that he was fired from one of his jobs for making fun about a cigarette commercial.
Oh.
And he said, and as I remember, Gary did smoke a lot at the time, but he made fun of it, and they kicked him off board, I guess, because of what he said against the client, or the client took umbrage or something, I don't know. But anyway, you know, so that sort of thing was going on there, and he was just trying to do his numbers, so to speak.
Right.
And I don't think he probably worked in commercial radio very much, because he'd mainly been on the BBC.
Well, I think Gary's sidebar is worth reading, but it'll disappoint some people, because it takes some of the mythology out of this whole pirate radio concept.
It does.
The idea of being out there, and often they were working 2-3 hour shifts a day, there was simply nothing else to do. There were no internet connections. I don't think they had televisions. And so it was, you had the potential of cabin fever with DJ mates that you didn't know before you got there, and probably didn't want to know after you left.
That's true. That's true. I imagine Gary didn't talk about that too much in his sidebar, but he said that I made some remarks in my review about how the groupies are partied with by the jocks in the movie, but he said that a couple of women who were brought on board ship to do some organizing of the ship, he said went unmolested or something like that. And knowing Gary, I'm sure that was true.
Because he's such a perfect gentleman.
He's such a perfect gentleman. He's married, and he's got about 8 or 10 children from all the way from England to Australia. He's a neat guy.
Well, check out the review at TulsaTVMemories.com, and if you dare, check out the film Pirate Radio. It'll be on a big screen, but perhaps not for too long. Gary Chu, thanks for joining me today.
Peter B., I'd like to say real quickly, if there's a movie coming up before long at Thanksgiving that you might want to take in, and I have seen it very early. I won't tell you much about it, other than it's the new Cormac McCarthy movie called The Road.
All right. Well, I will look for that, and I'll check it out. Thank you for the advance tip.
And you can edit that part out if you want, Peter B.
No, Gary, we're not going to edit, and we're going to leave your editing instructions in just to embarrass you. Happy trails, dude.
Bye.
Thank you, Gary. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com, or else.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails.